Always by Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here as always.
So our topic for today, Jonathan, is what you do. It's not just history, it's historians and how they perform their craft. Recently, Nicholas Kristof, the great, and I use that term intentionally, the great columnist and journalist for the New York Times, wrote kind of a different sort of piece for him, basically addressed at the Academics of America, saying you're not playing the intellectual leadership role you should be playing. You're stuck sort of in your own little world. He called them, I believe, medieval monks and called for them to return to their old status as public intellectuals. So you're in the academy. You're a historian. How do you react?
Well, look, I had a lot of sympathy with the piece. It begins with the line, professors, we need you. And I do think that the country needs what professors have to sell. The problem is most professors actually aren't selling it. They produce knowledge for each other. That was not historically the case 100 years ago, especially in my own profession, but particularly since really the Cold War, since mid-century, most professional historians, and I think most people in the humanities overall, and certainly in the natural sciences, have written really for each other. I think Kristof's right about that.
But there's a paradox here, because I look at the bookshelves in my living room, and they're filled with books of history written by best-selling writers of history, Doris Kearns Goodwin, James McPherson, David McCullough. You know, what gives here?
Well, what gives is that professional historians have seeded the market for history to other people who write history. You know, if you look 100 years ago, the people who were at the top of my field, that is history, with names like Charles and Mary Beard or Carl Becker, they all wrote books for public consumption. Even into the Cold War, a figure like Richard Hofstadter, he wrote a book called The American Political Tradition, and it was a bestseller. It sold over a million copies. I think what happened after Hofstadter's time, especially in the 60s and 70s, is that historians really ceded that landscape to, well, mostly journalists who write history. They started writing for each other, and journalists moved into the breach.
Okay, that's what happened. Why did it happen?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons for it, but one of the first is that we're talking about the era of the real boom in the university, what Clark Kerr in the early 60s would call the multiversity. You know, we forget that before the 50s and 60s, we didn't really have mass higher education in this country the way we understand it. But thanks to the Higher Education Act and especially federal student loans, other kinds of prosperity in the country, college became not a ubiquitous experience, but a mass experience. And what that meant is that there were many more jobs in the academy for people like me. So there was much less incentive, I would say, to cultivate a public audience because there were jobs in which you could just write for each other.
And part of the culture of the academy was, or at least has developed to be, that writing for each other is a way to earn prestige and writing for a mass audience is a way to lose prestige.
Absolutely, to lose it. I mean, I should say that I'm very much of an outlier here. I am a professional historian. I do write academic books, but obviously here I am on the radio in HYY, and I'm a frequent op-ed columnist. I would say that when I started this gig about 20 years ago, that this was a demerit. I had senior colleagues tell me to stop it and stop it right away because it would mark me as a facile scholar because, you know, if any average Joe can understand what it is I'm writing, how deep could it be? I would say that in some ways that prejudice has gone away to what we just call a kind of indifferent neutrality. I don't hear anybody dissing me for that anymore, but it certainly doesn't help me when it comes to things like tenure and promotion.
We're talking to Jonathan Zimmerman of New York University. He's an historian, and we're talking about what has happened to the craft of writing history and the issue of who is history for or who are history books for. What was it that motivated you to ignore that criticism and plunge ahead and write for mass audiences as well as academic ones?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, I do have a background as a journalist. I was the editor of my college newspaper, and I've written for newspapers for many years. So I'm familiar with that medium, I think, in the way that it's fair to say a lot of academics aren't. But there's more to it than that. Frankly, the books that I write, despite my best efforts, don't get read by a lot of people, and I just can't get up in the morning thinking that I'm going to spend my life only writing for 1,000 people. I respect people who make that choice, but I can't make it.
So Nicholas Kristof in his column had a purpose. He believes that there is a public purpose, an important societal purpose played by having people who have delved deep and whether it's in the social sciences or history or I guess even literature, come back with some nuggets from that deep dive to share them with the society and the culture at large. And he called for a return to the idea of the public intellectual, for academics who know something deeply to engage with public issues and the culture. Who would be a model from history of the kind of thing he's talking about? Who were the great public intellectuals before this transition took place?
Well, I think people like Charles and Mary Beard and people like Richard Hofstadter, who I mentioned earlier. But I should also say that we do have them today. I mean, there are people that do this and do this brilliantly. James McPherson, a Princeton historian who wrote, really the standard survey book about the Civil War. And, there are many other examples. William Cronin at the University of Wisconsin and others, but I do think they're exceptional because we still, as a profession, haven't put a premium on this. Academicians, like everybody else, they're very good judges of their own self-interest. And especially in historical studies, we actually haven't made it in the self-interest of enough scholars to do this, even though there are scholars who do it and do it very well.
There's been a recent development in this vein, a little more focused on technology and science perhaps than the humanities, but the TED Talk has become clearly a phenomenon, and it is a way that some people from the academy have taken their key idea, their key insight, and taken it public in a very modern way, but some TED Talk videos get an enormous number of hits online. And some of those people who give TED Talks then take an enormous number of hits from their colleagues for doing it.
Yeah, it depends on the person and on the context. I think this is a hugely salutary development, as are blogs, right, which provide another great outlet for people to kind of get their ideas out there in the way that Nick Kristof wants. And I do think that's a hugely positive development. But what the universities have to do, again, is not just tolerate it or accept it, but really recognize and promote it. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. The most basic one, and I agree with Kristof, I do think we have important things to say that the public needs to hear. But in my own discipline also, I think there's actually, to go back to self-interest, a self-interested reason for doing it, which is the age of the multiversity is coming to a close. And the kind of jobs that I was lucky enough to get, a tenure-track job at a research university, are in decline. So I believe that we have some good self-interested reason to promote this because a lot of us and the people we're training just aren't going to be able to get these university sinecures that people like me got.
These are matters of fairly deeply embedded culture in American colleges and universities, but the pace of change around that culture has been
glacial.
Yeah, but now is accelerating thanks to technology and some other issues. If Jonathan Zimmerman, we had this same conversation 5 years from now, would you predict that Nicholas Kristof would still be lamenting and asking for more outward-facing and sort of public-facing historians and social scientists? Or do you think he's on the front end of a change?
There won't be very much change. The reason I can answer that is, as a historian who specializes in education, I know that universities are deeply conservative institutions. No matter what the, quote, politics of the people who work there are and who they vote for, they're conservative in a dictionary sense. That is, they change extremely slowly. There are some good reasons for that. I mean, there are some values that universities are enjoined to conserve, and they should. But often I ask my students, let's imagine that, Theodore Roosevelt, for example, himself a historian, came back to, the United States today and started looking around. He would be so astonished by, changes in communication, transportation, gender and race relations, the family. But then if you brought him into the university, my university or any other, he'd say, I kind of recognize this. There's a professor up there. He's drawing away, or she now, right? And the students are taking some notes or maybe now surfing the internet, right? But the general structures of the way we do business have changed so much more slowly. Universities change more slowly than almost any other institution.
And on that note, let's thank once again our own university professor, Jonathan Zimmerman of New York University. This has been That's History. And as always, Jonathan, a pleasure.
Thanks. It was fun.